he's Hitler. And then they say, he's a Nazi. I'm not a Nazi. I'm the opposite of a Nazi.
What's the opposite of a Nazi? Communist? Anti-fascist? He's Antifa.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Oh, no.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I knew we'd finally find Antifa. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding, on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon, on the Central Coast, on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio, on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast, or as we call it around here, the Love Fest. Good to have you with us. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
Good to have you with us as well.
Hi.
We had planned to have a guest for you on today's show, who I had been actually hoping to speak with for a while in advance of the election, but sadly, he contacted us at the last minute to say he suddenly took ill, that he is okay, but it seems to be the flu or the COVID, and that he wouldn't be able to join us today after all.
Neither of those are fun.
Neither of those are fun, which is why, by the way, I took my vaccinations over the weekend.
Yes, me too. I got vaccinated for flu and COVID, and I feel much better now.
Yes, neither of which were fun to get the shots, but
right.
I feel better now heading into the holidays having taken them. Anyway, we will see if it's possible to reschedule that guest before next week's election. I don't know if we can or not, but we will take the opportunity today to catch up with a few things that I've wanted to get to, and we will try to make up for our lack of guests today on tomorrow's show by having not one, but two guests.
Yay.
Yes, we will be joined, I think, for the last time before Election Day, now just 1 week away, by our old friends Heather Digby Parton and Driftglass for their closing thoughts, their closing message in the final days of an extraordinary, I think it's fair to say, historically consequential election on the day after the Democratic candidate Kamala Harris delivers what the campaign is describing as her own closing argument from the Ellipse in D.C., the very same spot where Donald Trump on January 6th of 2021 encouraged his supporters to march to the Capitol and, quote, fight like hell to prevent the peaceful transfer of power during the congressional certification of Joe Biden's victory that year. And, well, you may have heard what happened thereafter that day. Harris is set to speak at the Ellipse to her supporters not long after we're off the air today. So we'll cover anything newsworthy from those remarks or any attempted insurrections that her supporters might try to bring to the Capitol afterwards. That will be, of course, in our coverage on our next thrilling Bradcast with Digby and Driftglass. Today, then, for a start, I want to pick up a bit where we left off on yesterday's coverage of the bizarre and yet totally understandable, frankly, matter of these billionaire oligarch owners of the both the Washington Post, owned by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, and the Los Angeles Times, owned by South African-born billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong, who is very close friends with South African-born billionaire and Donald Trump supporter Elon Musk, purportedly the world's richest man. In both cases, both billionaires spiked planned endorsements of Democratic candidate Kamala Harris just before their editorial boards at each paper were to run them late last week in advance of Tuesday's election day. Now, both papers have been facing consequences for their owners' decisions in the days since then, with resignations of members of their editorial board, among other things. But the consequences for now have reverberated the most, it seems, with the Washington Post, the legendary paper, as we discussed yesterday, where Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein back in the 1970s stood up to the then most powerful man in the country. They stood up to him. That would be President Richard Nixon, to expose the Watergate scandal, eventually leading to Nixon's downfall and his resignation in disgrace to avoid an almost certain impeachment and removal from office by Congress. You know, back when Republican members of Congress still had at least some dignity and some respect for the U.S. Constitution and the rule of law. Simpler times. As NPR's David Folkenflik reported on Monday afternoon, the Washington Post has been rocked by a tidal wave of cancellations from subscribers and a series of resignations from columnists as the paper grapples with the fallout of owner Jeff Bezos's decision to block an endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris for president. So how's that obeying fascists in advance before they even come to power? How's that working out for you, Jeff? Apparently not so well. More than 200,000 people had canceled their digital subscriptions by midday Monday, according to two people at the paper with knowledge of internal matters, NPR's Folkenflik reports. The figure represents about 8% of the paper's paid circulation of 2.5 million subscribers.
That is a significant chunk.
And with the number of cancellations continuing to grow on Monday afternoon, that number is likely more about 10%. That's a huge number. In fact, the Post's former executive editor, Marcus Brockley, told NPR, quote, "It's a colossal number." Chief executive and publisher, the already scandal-plagued and former Rupert Murdoch lackey, Will Lewis, at the Washington Post, explained the decision not to endorse in this year's presidential race for the first time in nearly 50 years to be a return to the Post's roots, which has, for years, styled itself as a, quote, independent paper. Few people, writes Folkenflik, inside the paper credit that rationale, given the particular timing just days before a neck-and-neck race between Harris and former President Donald Trump. Former executive editor Marty Baron voiced skepticism, telling NPR, quote, "If this decision had been made 3 years ago, 2 years ago, maybe even a year ago, that would have been fine," he said. "It's a certainly a reasonable decision, but this was made within a couple weeks of the election, and there was no substantive, serious deliberation with the editorial board of the paper. It was clearly made," he said, "for other reasons, not for reasons of high principle." Even at the rival New York Times, with a much, much higher circulation level, a significant protest might register in the low thousands, as opposed to 200,000 at the Post over the last day or two. Earlier this year, NPR notes, the Post publisher had actually touted the paper's net gain of just 4,000 subscribers as being noteworthy. That was a big number at the time. We got 4,000 new subscribers. Things are going great here at the Post. They just lost 200,000 subscribers. Three of the top 10 viewed stories on the Post website on Sunday, noted Folk and Flick, were articles written by Post staffers who were outraged by Bezos' decision. The top one was humor columnist Alexander Petri's piece headlined, quote, "It has fallen to me, the humor columnist, to endorse Harris for president." More than 174,000 people had read it online. In the days since Bezos' decision, two columnists have resigned from the paper and two writers have stepped down from the editorial board. One of those writers, Molly Roberts, warned of the possible consequences of the 11th hour decision to stay quiet rather than publish the editorial endorsing Harris. Quote, "Donald Trump is not yet a dictator," she wrote in a statement posted on social media, "but the quieter we are, the closer he comes." And that, to me, is much more important than the 200,000 subscribers that they may have lost. But we'll get to more of that in a moment. The other writer is David Hoffman, who accepted a Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing on Thursday of last week.
Ouch.
The day before the Bezos decision was made public. He said, quote, "For decades," this was in a letter on Monday this week explaining his decision to leave the editorial board, "for decades, the Washington Post editorials have been a beacon of light, signaling hope to dissidents, political prisoners, and the voiceless. When victims of repression were harassed, exiled, imprisoned, and murdered, we made sure the whole world knew the truth." I guess not anymore. And at a time when we really need the Washington Post to tell the whole world the truth. Hoffman added, "I believe we face a very real threat of autocracy in the candidacy of Donald Trump. I find it untenable and unconscionable that we have lost our voice." Former columnist Robert Kagan, an editor-at-large, explained his decision on CNN on Friday, his decision to resign from the paper. He said, quote, "We are, in fact, bending the knee to Donald Trump because we're afraid of what he will do." Noting that officials from Bezos' Blue Origin aerospace company had met with Trump just a few hours after the decision became public. Totally a coincidence. Blue Origin happens to have a multi-billion dollar contract with NASA. During the Trump administration, you may recall, Amazon sued the government after alleging that it had blocked a $10 billion cloud computing services contract with the Pentagon over the then president's ire about coverage, yes, in the Washington Post, which Bezos owns personally. So we know what Donald Trump will do.
Yeah, he'll retaliate against all your other businesses if you don't kowtow to him at your newspaper.
And now, of course, we know what he will, what the newspaper owners will do in that case. They will, yep, in fact, kowtow to him. All of which puts a spotlight, for me at least, on an interview published yesterday with longtime national security advisor, including as an official under Donald Trump, and an expert on authoritarian regimes, Fiona Hill. She's an expert on all of this, given her firsthand close-up view working with autocrats like, you know, Russia's Vladimir Putin. And much as we highlighted fascism expert Timothy Snyder on yesterday's program, responding to the decision by the Post and the LA Times billionaire owners by citing his lesson one warning from his landmark 2017 book on tyranny, warning those facing the rise of a fascist regime to not, quote, obey in advance, as clearly Bezos and Sun Chong have done here. Just to quote the key paragraph again, since it may become even more imperative and important in the days ahead, depending on how things go after Election Day, 1 week away, quote, "Do not obey in advance. Most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given. In times like these, individuals think about what a more repressive government will want and then offer themselves without being asked. A citizen who adapts in this way, says Snyder, is teaching power what it can do. I promise Donald Trump learned a lesson from what those papers did and what he'll be able to get away with in the future if he's elected. In any event, like Timothy Snyder, Fiona Hill has some insights worth sharing today, I think, from an interview with Maura Reynolds over at Politico magazine, published on Monday, headlined, "His Loyalty is Not Necessarily to the United States." Fiona Hill explains Trump, Elon Musk, and why they both talk to Putin. The news of the past few weeks has included some developments that on their own could seem minor, writes Reynolds. Since he left office, Donald Trump has held a half dozen phone calls with Vladimir Putin. Elon Musk is also talking regularly to the Russian leader. A couple of newspaper owners decided their newspaper's editorial board should not make an endorsement in the presidential election. But for Fiona Hill, the former Trump advisor, who is one of the world's top experts on Russia and Putin, these events create a worrisome pattern. In an interview with Politico magazine, Hill, like other scholars and historians with an expertise in autocratic regimes, said she sees the American political system already drifting into autocracy even before Trump is potentially elected. A key sign is that members of the country's billionaire class are acting more and more like oligarchs. Thinking about Trump and Putin and Musk as fellow oligarchs helps explain why they all seem so enthralled with each other. As Hill noted, they are part of a very small group of men. I should note, a very small group of small men.
True.
Who control vast fortunes and vast political power that have global reach and who prefer to deal with each other. Not, you know, the pesky rabble like you and me. Quote, they aren't driven by the people they represent or the companies that they represent, but by the peer group that they are in, which is an extraordinarily small group of people, Hill said. Their interactions are all about them figuring out how to exercise power together. When it comes to Musk, he's promoting Trump's candidacy and transacting with Putin because it serves his own interests in amassing political and financial power, Hill said. Quote, his loyalty is not necessarily to the United States. And apparently that is true for all of them. It's a fascinating, detailed interview, and I'll link to the full thing when I post today's show at bradblog.com because it's behind a paywall, but I'll post a free link to it. You should definitely read the whole thing, but I want to share just a few excerpts here related to some of these particular topics directly. Politico asks about the decision by the owners of the Washington Post and LA Times to kowtow to Trump even before he's elected. Hill responds, quote, we can see this in every single case where a country has started to slide towards autocracy. No matter what people might think about bias in the media, in national newspapers, the press, online publications, these outlets are one of two main ways that regular people have to check power inside of the country. The other one being the courts. She says we've seen over and over again in autocratic and oligarchical settings that the courts become stacked in favor of the people who are already running the country. Well, that seems to ring a bell there, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And she adds, once newspapers get taken over by business interests, those newspapers become less about free speech and more about profits or political influence for the person who owns them. And if that billionaire owner has other businesses that are tied to the state, like state service contracts, then that becomes incredibly problematic. Oh, I think we're at the incredibly problematic stage at this point. She says, I think, sadly, we're now seeing a very similar pattern in the U.S. The quid pro quo there, in the case of Bezos, as his executives at his aerospace companies were meeting with Trump. She says that quid pro quo is pretty obvious. It's extraordinarily troubling because this is the kind of pattern that one would never have expected to see in the United States. And guess what? We're seeing it now. Politico asks, is that one of the things that's different in 2024 compared with 2016 or 2020? She says, yes, you're starting to see that newspaper owners are worried about the other parts of their business and how it will be affected by a Trump who might be vengeful against them. That's one of Trump's hallmarks, she says. He's already talked about the media as the enemy of the state, but he has also targeted their owners in the past. He's already made an example of Jeff Bezos, who was punished for his criticisms when Trump was in power previously by Trump trying to deny Amazon major government contracts. That's exactly a hallmark of an oligarchy or of an autocracy, she says. They go on to discuss how strongman leaders often come to power via democratic elections, as the strongman tends to pit various groups, ethnic, religious, professional, etc., against each other. Sound familiar?
That also sounds familiar.
And so Politico asks, I could see some Americans might think that having a strong person, leader, on the world stage is a good thing for the United States. But what is the downside for ordinary people of that style of leadership? Fiona Hill says, well, the downside for ordinary people is that they don't really exist to that kind of leader. With a strong man in charge, there's no interface, no mediation between the people and the guy on top. All the other institutions that you rely on, either Congress or the mayors, the governors, your local authorities, the courts, everything is subservient to the big guy, not to the people. She says what you see in Russia and in other similar places is that people shrink into their tiny family and friends groups and smaller communities out of fear that they could be subjected to the wrath of the guy at the top. In Russia, for many years, there was a general feeling that Putin was leaving the ordinary people alone, Hill says. The ordinary person is not being left alone anymore. They're being sent to war. They are being repressed. Somebody who supports Trump today and thinks that he's their champion could very easily be on the other end of the spectrum tomorrow. Are you hearing this, MAGA? They could go from being a supporter of Trump to somebody who Trump sees as an opponent just by being in the wrong category of people, or by saying or doing something publicly that he does not like. Speech that now seems free and unfettered on X or Twitter or anywhere else on the internet, or even privately to a friend, could easily be turned against you. That's happened over and over and over again in Russia and in many other settings, she says. How close are we to that in the United States? Asks Politico. Fiona Hill answers, well, we're one election away. So, yeah, this year's election, which I have referred to frequently as the most critical in U.S. history, that is exactly why. That is exactly why we are one election away. To that end, I shared part of Philadelphia Inquirer and columnist and friend of the show Will Bunch's latest column on all of this yesterday, including where he wrote, quote, what happened at the Post and the LA Times was a stunning betrayal of journalism's moral values, but in a strange way, the papers did perform a public service, showing American voters what life under a dictator would feel like. And he's right. It's exactly what it was. So in one sense, I'm very happy about it. Because that's, that's what it's like under a dictator. And in that case, we've got just two papers. Wait until that happens to all of them. Donald Trump has already made threats again, over and over again, against the media, against journalism, against CBS, NBC, ABC. And this is just in the past month or so, threatening to take away their licenses. They actually don't have licenses unless they own affiliate stations. Yeah. But he wants to go after them. He said as much.
And there are ways.
He wants them to go away. And by the way, his main beef against CBS is that he doesn't like the way they edited their interview with Kamala Harris. And of course, he doesn't give a damn about the way they edited the interview with Kamala Harris.
No.
What he wants you to not notice is that for the first time in about 50 years, a president running for from a major party for a nominee running for president of the United States was too chicken to show up and do the interview with 60 Minutes, as was the case with Donald Trump. So instead, if he's talking about how they edited Kamala Harris's interview and how they have to have their broadcast license taken away, that's what he hopes we all talk about, instead of the fact that he was too damn chicken to show up and answer questions at this point, because he lives already in a bubble of fake news. Which you know, cannot stand even the minorest of fact checking. Can't stand that. That's why he stays over on Fox News and on the right. But additionally, there was another bright side to all of this that was noted by a writer over at Daily Kos.
It's just kind of funny to think of it as being some bright sides.
Well,
but
yeah.
I'll take them.
Well, we have to.
Yeah.
We have to. So a writer at Daily Kos pointed out the article was headlined "The Unintended Consequences of the Washington Post and LA Times Non-Endorsement." The writer, Cape Cod Mercury, says, "The more I think about it, the more I think this was ultimately a win for Harris. If the endorsements had gone through, it would have been something so ordinary and expected, it would have rated barely a notice. Sure, they would have shown up on lists of endorsements, but would they? But they wouldn't really have had any lasting effect. But because of the honorable actions of the editors at the Post and the Times resigning, the story of the owners blocking the endorsements became widely known. The resulting censorship story has gotten significantly more coverage, even in the Post itself and the Times. What is more," they write, "there is no doubt that the actual editors at the papers were endorsing Harris. If you write a story about a dog biting man, no one cares. But if you find a story about a man biting a dog, now that is newsworthy. In this case, Bezos and Soon Shiong have created a man bites dog story that has gotten far more coverage than a simple endorsement ever would." And that is true. That is undeniably true. Ultimately, I think that's probably a very good thing for Kamala Harris. But I would argue that it wasn't an interest in defending Kamala Harris that led these two papers, or at least the owners of the paper, to spike the endorsement from their paper's editorial boards. It was the interest in pleasing and staying in the good graces of Donald Trump. In the event that somehow he wins this election. And on that, and despite the massive loss of subscriptions, which, at least in Bezos' case, where owning the Washington Post is really sort of a hobby or a trophy more than anything, really, that's a drop in the bucket for him. That would also be true if the entire paper went out of business tomorrow. That would be a drop in the bucket for him. It'd be a lot worse for us, for the country, for journalism. But, you know, those of us who actually care about democracy, but for that, I do take the writer's point there. And to that end, let's also use this as an excuse today to do something I normally wouldn't do, which is highlight the New York Times' editorial board and apparently their closing message before Election Day, as published, ironically, on the same day that Washington Post announced that they were spiking their own editorial board's endorsement of Kamala Harris. The epic 23-word headline, which ran in the paper version of the Times with a huge all caps font on the front page of the Sunday opinion section covered the entire page instead of using a photo, as would usually be the case. Well, the headline itself tells much of the story. Donald Trump says he will prosecute his enemies, order mass deportations, use soldiers against citizens, abandon allies, play politics with disasters. Believe him. Quite a headline. And yes, it does tell much of the story, but let's take a quick break here. And when we return, we will tell you, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. Right after this. Also later this hour, by the way, Desi Doyen with our latest Green News Report on the critical climate and energy choices on the ballot this year and how they will affect the U.S. economy. In short, bigly.
Yes.
All of that is also straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Careful what you wish for, cause you just might get it. And if you get it, then you just might not know what to do with it, cause it might just come back on you tenfold. I said be careful what you wish for, cause
good
you
point.
Just might get it.
Yep.
And
Eminem.
If you get it, then you just might not know.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As the New York Times editorial board explained in its weekend piece with the epic headline, Donald Trump says he will prosecute his enemies, order mass deportations, use soldiers against citizens, abandon allies, play politics with disasters, believe him. They write, Donald Trump has described at length the dangerous and disturbing actions that he says he will take if he wins the presidency. His rallies offer a steady stream of such promises and threats, like prosecuting political opponents and using the military against U.S. citizens. These statements are so outrageous and outlandish, so openly in conflict with the norms and values of American democracy that many find them hard to regard as anything but bluster. We have two words for American voters, writes the New York Times editorial board. Believe him. The record, they say, shows that Mr. Trump often pursues his stated goals regardless of how plainly they lack legal or moral grounding. The record further shows that many of his most reckless efforts in his first administration were stymied only because of others in his administration who blocked or delayed or watered down his aims. Mr. Trump has learned from that experience to surround himself with supplicants who would instead obey his wishes and bring his words and ideas to life, even if they contradict facts, the public interest, or even the Constitution. For this reason, they say, Americans would be wise to see this language as a genuine threat, not simply Mr. Trump on a tangent. We should take the painful step of imagining America were his plans and promises to come to pass, to imagine the impacts to our culture, to our economy, to our security, to our shared commitment to the rule of law. Americans should believe him. Trump says he will use the Justice Department to punish people he doesn't like. Believe him. They write, after his conviction on 34 felony charges in New York back in May, Mr. Trump, in an interview with Newsmax, escalated his threats to use the Justice Department to go after his political enemies.
But wouldn't it be terrible to throw the president's wife and the former Secretary of State? Think of it, the former Secretary of State, but the president's wife into jail. Wouldn't that be a terrible thing? But they want to do it. So, you know, it's a terrible, terrible path that they're leading us to. And it's very possible that it's going to have to happen to them.
Mm. Why you should believe him, the Times says, as president, Mr. Trump repeatedly sought to use the power of government to punish his political opponents. He was open about trying to get other countries to do his bidding. His attempt to get Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden led to his first impeachment in 2019. Behind the scenes, he was relentless in trying to get his attorneys general and the IRS to investigate people that he thought had wronged him, including Hillary Clinton, his former rival, John Kerry, a former Secretary of State, his former FBI director, James Comey, and Andrew McCabe, Mr. Comey's deputy. None of these efforts led to any charges being filed, but if he is reelected, Mr. Trump will continue to use the Justice Department to harass his enemies. Mr. Trump has made clear that he intends to pick DOJ officials who will take orders from the Oval Office. According to NPR, during the current campaign, Mr. Trump has made more than 100 specific threats, quote, to investigate, prosecute, jail, or otherwise punish, unquote, people that he regards as enemies, including Mr. Biden, Kamala Harris, members of Congress, judges, and prosecutors. Trump says he will round up and deport millions of immigrants. Believe him, they suggest. Standing on a dirt road alongside the Mexican border in Arizona back in August, Mr. Trump offered a version of the promise that has become his the signature of his third presidential campaign.
With your vote, we will seal the border, stop the invasion, and launch the largest deportation effort in American history.
So, the New York Times says, we should believe him. Mr. Trump has repeatedly said that he would move quickly to deport millions of people who are living in the U.S. A key aide, Stephen Miller, said last year that militarized detention camps, quote, large-scale staging grounds near the border would be constructed. Mr. Trump would have broad authority to pursue such a plan. Such a campaign would tear apart families, disrupt communities, and create a host of economic problems. Mr. Trump similarly promised mass deportations during his 2016 presidential campaign, but over the following 4 years, his administration deported only about 326,000. He was stopped from executing a much broader sweep by a lack of funding, as well as legal challenges and resistance from federal, state, and local officials. Mr. Trump's advisors on immigration policy say that they have learned from that experience and that this time they will be ready to mobilize the government's resources and withstand legal challenges. One idea, for example, that Trump has mentioned over and over again is to invoke the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, a law that could be used to deport legal immigrants as well. Trump says he will deploy the American military against U.S. citizens. In a Fox News interview on October 13, just weeks ago, Mr. Trump said he was primarily concerned about election interference by his domestic political opponents rather than by foreign nationals.
I think the bigger problem is the enemy from within, not even the people that have come in and destroying our country. By the way, totally destroying our country. The towns, the villages, they're being inundated. But I don't think they're the problem in terms of election day. I think the bigger problem are the people from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. And I think they're the and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military, because they can't let that happen.
So why the New York Times says you should believe him? Trump has shown his willingness to target people who oppose him and to subject or expose them to violence to suit his ends. After refusing to accept the results of the 2020 election, he incited rioters to sack the Capitol, and several people died as a result. 4 years later, he remains insistent that elections are only legitimate if he wins them. His power to cause problems after voting ends on November 5 is more limited than it was last time because he's not in power, but he could still try to foment violence. January 6 cannot be forgotten. His threats to deploy the military against his political opponents merely for being his political opponents are a sobering reminder of what kind of president he would be. In June of 2020, Mr. Trump threatened to send active duty military personnel into the streets of American cities to confront Black Lives Matter protesters. He wanted the soldiers to shoot them, according to his own defense secretary, Mark Esper, who then took the unusual step of publicly rebuffing the president. Good for him. Trump subsequently fired Mr. Esper, and the former president has made clear that if he is reelected, he intends to pick officials who will do what he says. He is implying that opposing him politically is, in his view, tantamount to treason. Trump also says he will allow vigilante violence to end crime. Believe him, says the New York Times, addressing what he has described as a plague of unchecked property crime in American cities. Mr. Trump, at a rally in September in Erie, Pennsylvania, suggested a brief burst of violence, of police violence, as a corrective.
One rough hour, and I mean real rough, the word will get out and it will end immediately.
Why you should believe him on that? Well, Mr. Trump has a long history of encouraging violence against those he accuses of crimes, a category that stretches from thieves to legal protesters, public officials, and, yes, journalists. He told people at his rallies to, quote, knock the crap out of protesters. On January 6, 2021, he told supporters to fight like hell to prevent Congress from confirming Mr. Biden's victory. And during the current campaign, he's repeatedly returned to the idea that the government should kill shoplifters. He called it a simple solution to retail theft. The violent language frequently deployed by Mr. Trump and his acolytes is contributing to an environment in which acts of political violence, especially by right-wing extremists, are increasingly common. Trump says he will order the military to strike foreign civilian targets if the United States is attacked. Civilian targets if the U.S. is attacked. Paper says we should believe him. At an event in North Carolina in September, Mr. Trump said the Biden administration has not done enough to protect him from assassination attempts, I should note, by registered Republicans. They've not done enough, including a possible Iranian plot to assassinate him.
But if I were the president, I would inform the threatening country, in this case Iran, that if you do anything to harm this person, we are going to blow your largest cities and the country itself to smithereens. We're going to blow it to smithereens. You can't do that.
So why you should believe him on that? Well, as president, he would have broad powers to authorize military action against a foreign country. And the U.S. has often responded to acts of state-sponsored terrorism with military force. If Iran committed an act of terrorism or tried to harm an American official, Mr. Trump would have the authority to launch a strike against the country. In similar situations, presidents have retaliated against military and intelligence targets. But what Trump is describing, blowing up cities, would go far beyond those boundaries. Blowing up cities, yes, like Israel, by the way, has blown up Gaza, the cities in Gaza, which Trump supports. Tells Netanyahu to do whatever you want. But I digress. During the closing days of Mr. Trump's presidency, General Mark Milley, the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff appointed by Donald Trump, reportedly became so concerned about the possibility of an illegal, unauthorized, or accidental military strike that he instructed the Joint Chiefs to ensure that no unlawful orders were carried out and that no actions were taken without calling him first. When John Kelly was serving as Trump's Secretary of Homeland Security, and James Mattis was serving as his Secretary of Defense, the AP reported that the two men made a private agreement not to leave the country at the same time, so that one of them would always be on hand to restrain the president. Last month, more than 700 former and current national security officials released a letter describing Mr. Trump as unfit for the presidency because he is vengeful and impulsive. If Mr. Trump's own top advisors did not trust him to use force with prudence and restraint, can the American public Trump says he will punish blue states by withholding disaster relief. The New York Times says we should believe him. At a rally in Coachella Valley in October, Trump suggested that he would withhold emergency aid for California after wildfires unless the state's Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom, complied with his demands for changes in totally unrelated agriculture policies.
We're going to take care of our farmers. We're going to take care of your water situation. And we'll force it down his throat. And we'll say, Gavin, if you don't do it, we're not giving you any of that fire money that we send you all the time for all the forest fires that you have.
We'll force it down his throat. Why you should believe him? Well, when he was president, Trump repeatedly sought to prevent the distribution of emergency aid to places that were run by Democrats. His administration delayed more than $20 billion in emergency aid for Puerto Rico, or that floating island of garbage, as it was described at Donald Trump's rally over the weekend, that after Hurricane Maria struck the island back in 2017, but it expedited aid for the Florida Panhandle, very Republican-leaning Florida Panhandle, after Hurricane Michael struck just the following year. After wildfires swept through California in 2018, the president initially declined to approve the emergency aid. His own senior official on his National Security Council told Politico recently that the funding was approved only after aides presented Trump with data showing that there were more Trump supporters in Orange County, California, than the entire state of Iowa. During the COVID pandemic, Mr. Trump urged Congress to require blue states to adopt his political policy priorities, including the elimination of sanctuary cities and payroll taxation, to be eligible to receive emergency aid during the worst pandemic in 100 years. Trump says he will use ideological tests to decide which public schools get federal money. Believe him, the New York Times warns. Federal government provides only about 11% of public elementary and high school funding, and Congress establishes the conditions, but school districts rely on that funding, especially in lower income communities. So he could try to withhold funding in defiance of Congress, as some conservative legal theorists are now eager to test the boundaries between the two branches. School vaccination mandates, which are on the books in all 50 states. Those have played a critical role in reducing the spread of infectious diseases. Eliminating those requirements would invite a public health disaster. Simply put, it would cause the deaths of American children, the New York Times writes. One alarming piece of evidence is that states that make it easier for families to claim exemptions from the requirements already experience higher rates of measles and other infectious diseases. And finally, the paper notes that Trump says he will abandon U.S. allies, and that, too, we should believe him. I will link to that article with a free link so you can see the argument they make on that point.
Yes, there is much more in there. And hearing it all put together really does underscore how very dangerous, what a dangerous place we are in right now as a nation.
In this case, you know, it's about his plans to get out of NATO. Well, since he has left office, Congress has passed a law that will not allow the president to pull us out of NATO without congressional approval. So we would still be in NATO, but as the paper says, by reducing the numbers of troops dedicated to NATO, which is up to the president, some experts describe that as quiet quitting. Quiet quitting NATO. So we'd still be in it. We just wouldn't be there to do what is actually needed to protect democracy, you know, the whole purpose of NATO. Clearly, Donald Trump has no interest in protecting democracy. Donald Trump is running for president solely to protect himself. In the current case, from a life in either prison and or as a criminal defendant, much of which he will be able to make go away if he is president. But he is not running for president to protect you or to protect me or the country or the Constitution or anything but himself. And both his words and his deeds are making that really damn clear. We should believe him. We'll see if we do. Quick break. And Desi Doyen will have our latest Green News report with a few thoughts on the choice that voters are now making when it comes to, the survival of humanity.
Yeah, you know, not much.
Do you think Donald Trump gives a damn about even that? Don't hold your breath. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is The Bradcast. You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. And just in case, the American way of life, the Constitution, tyranny, and everything else aren't at stake in the upcoming election, so is the climate and the U.S. economy.
Oh, yes.
As discussed in our latest Green News report.
Trump's Brown New Deal is going to kill the economy.
Climate and the U.S. economy are on the ballot.
Either leaders bridge the emissions gap, or we plunge headlong into climate disaster.
World on pace for significant and dangerous warming without faster action, UN warns. Plus, Biden cracks down on lead paint, a serious threat to America's children.
All of those threats and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Today, Harris got a big thumbs up from 82 American Nobel Prize winners endorsing Harris, writing, "This is the most consequential presidential election in a long time, perhaps ever, for the future of science." So no big deal, but the smartest people on Earth fear the end of science. As Charles Darwin once wrote, "Trump might win. Screw it. I'm going back to being a monkey." Ooh, ooh, ah, ah.
This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, so not much at stake in the upcoming election, just the future of science and the future of humanity. But where should we kick off today?
Well, let's start with the United Nations Environment Program's annual emissions gap report out this week.
Okay.
And it is not good. Global fossil fuel emissions are still rising, and humanity is on pace for significantly more warming. We are on track to blow past the Paris Agreement's targets, potentially reaching a catastrophic 3 degrees Celsius of warming above pre-industrial levels by the end of this century, meaning more daunting cuts will be required in coming years to stave off the worst impacts. If nations only achieve their current pledges in the Paris Agreement, warming could be limited to 2.5 degrees Celsius, bringing ever more unprecedented heat waves, droughts, storms, fires, floods, and rising sea levels. But to hit the critical Paris target of 2 degrees Celsius or the 1.5 degrees Celsius target, all nations must do more and do it faster, reducing fossil fuel emissions by more than 7% a year by 2035.
So basically, we're on track to go twice as far as scientists recommended that we should.
Yep. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was characteristically blunt.
There is a direct link between increasing emissions and increasingly frequent and intense climate disasters. We're playing with fire, but there can be no more playing for time. They're out of time.
Out of time. That's great.
So with all that in mind, in the last days of the U.S. presidential election, voters face a stark choice between two very different paths to the future, a chasm of difference, and the climate stakes could not be higher. Vice President Kamala Harris has called climate change an existential threat and has committed to advancing the Biden administration's infrastructure and climate policies and the manufacturing and jobs boom it is generating. Harris vows House to expand cheaper renewable energy and investments in electric grid and infrastructure upgrades for resilience against extreme weather disasters, clean up air and water pollution, reduce energy costs for consumers and homeowners, electrify school buses, keep the U.S. on target to cut emissions that drive climate change, and much more.
Well, that sounds good, and I'm sure Donald Trump is very similar.
Well, former President Donald Trump is the polar opposite.
What?
He has called climate change a hoax and a scam and promises to halt all of that, repealing Biden's landmark climate law and its investments in infrastructure and energy efficiency, ending incentives for U.S.-based manufacturing of renewable energy, batteries, and electric vehicles, cancel U.S. offshore wind projects, and weaken regulations on industrial air and water pollution while increasing the drilling and use of fossil fuels that cause climate change.
Sounds wonderful.
The American Prospect Ryan Cooper explained in a recent broadcast that the path voters choose will have profound impacts on the U.S. economy and global competitiveness for decades.
The whole world is re-gearing everything to be around renewable energy, the cheapest energy in most of the world that's ever been produced. And so to do Trump's Brown New Deal to subsidize basically oil and gas at the expense of green energy is going to kill the economy. And we're going to fall behind China and Europe.
So Trump's plan will set us back behind Europe and China, the nation that he says we need to compete with, right?
Exactly.
Brilliant.
Finally, just weeks after setting a nationwide deadline for removal of lead water pipes, the Biden Environmental Protection Agency has implemented strict new limits on dust from lead-based paint in older homes and childcare facilities. Lead-based paint was banned in 1978, but an estimated 30 million homes still contain it. Lead exposure, even at low levels, can seriously harm children, causing developmental delays and irreversible lifelong health impacts.
So even while we are all distracted with the election, President Biden is actually getting stuff done.
Yes.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Yeah, we're out of time, too. Thank
yes,
you very
are.
Much, Desi Doyen. Well done. Yep. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That, no paywall, is made possible by those of you who hit a donate button. We could really use your support right now. Or you can go straight to bradblog.com/donate. And, hey, sign up for a monthly subscription. Still, no paywall. Everyone gets to read the Brad Blog. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. Desi is Green News Report.
Yep.
Digby and Driftglass tomorrow. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Go vote, America.